of its understanding. So if you don't know the prayer, but you can participate by catching hold of the sound through your ears, capture the sound. Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Gopijana Vallabha Giribhadari.
Gopijana Vallabha Giribhadari.
Gopijana Vallabha Giribhadari.
Gopijana
Yasoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Yasoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Jai Radha Madhava. Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Giribhadari. Yasoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Yasoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari.
Thank you.
So, this word jai, probably some of you are wondering, what is this jai? Jai is simply a way of expressing enthusiasm for, or it can be translated variously as all glories to, or praise to, or victory to, whatever. Victory would refer to the fact that we want to transcend ignorance by coming to the platform of knowledge. That is our victory. Tamasi ma. Don't remain in darkness. Tama. Jyotir gama. Come to the light. There are certain self-evident truths which any rational thinking person must deal with in his life. And that's actually the difference between a two-legged animal and a human being, the power to discriminate between real and unreal. The Bhagavad Gita is some 700 verses spoken by Krishna to Arjuna in the middle of a fratricidal war. Fratricidal, I don't know. Different people pronounce it differently. This is delineated in the Mahabharata, which is also another very famous work. I think one Englishman, Peter Brooks, made a very famous play on the Mahabharata. Anyway, it's quite well known, just as the Ramayana. So there are 700 verses, and they didn't tell me which one I should speak on today. So we just opened the book, and we're going to take potluck, as they say. We'll see what we came to. We're reading from the 8th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, which is sometimes called Attaining the Supreme. So in the first 6 chapters, Krishna describes the different systems of yoga. Karma yoga. Yoga of work. How one can work according to his nature and attain perfection by going beyond karma. There's karma, vikarma, and akarma. Karma means work according to scriptural guidelines. Scriptural guidelines means that there is a user's manual, manufacturer's instruction manual. Just like everything, you get a tape recorder, you get a microphone, you get a webcam, camera, and a computer. If you're like me, you hate to read manuals, but they always give big thick manual, and usually if you read it, you don't break your camera or your tape recorder so quickly. It's good advice to read the manual. So similarly, the creation, the manufacturer, has given a manual. Saha yagya praja shrishtva puravacha prajapati anena prashavishyad vameshavos trishta kama duk. In the Vedas, it is said that this manual, if we follow it, we can live in this world harmoniously with nature and live abundantly and attain spiritual life, attain spiritual knowledge. So Jnana Yoga, after Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, yoga of knowledge in the sense that one tries to understand God, and this is a twist, one tries to understand God by understanding everything that God is not. It's one way of looking at it. Not this, not this, not this. Finally, when you've negated everything and there's, you know, something left, that's the supreme, that's the absolute. Then there is Ashtanga Yoga, which is Ashta means eight, and there's a system of gradual elevation, and the third stage of that Ashtanga Yoga is called Asana Yoga. Yam Niyam Asana. Asana, this is an asana that I'm sitting on. Asana is sometimes called Hatha Yoga. Now the purpose of Hatha Yoga is to maintain a slim body and to have good sex life. No, that's not the purpose of Hatha Yoga. Although some people think it is. Hatha Yoga is simply to calm the mind, to sit peacefully after following some guidelines of purity, yam and niyam. One cannot practice yoga if he is an animal, no matter if he may have material wealth, he may have power, he may have fame, but if he's basically an animal, and we've heard of such people in the world, one of them is giving trouble to a lot of people in the world nowadays, George Bush. yam, niyam, some rules and regulations. You want to control your mind and elevate yourself. Udared atmanatmanam natmanam avashadayat. You want to elevate yourself by your mind. You want to make your mind your assistant or your servant, not that you become the servant of your mind, because the mind has a tendency to wander here and there and you become dragged along like a slave. That's not very good. You can't expect to be peaceful or happy in such a condition. The mind can degrade you to such an extent that you may have everything that anyone could want and be totally miserable if your mind is disturbed. So there are various guidelines or rules which are described in the Bhagavad Gita as prasadam or mercy, the regulative principles of freedom. For example, people, when they first come across the devotees or the followers of Vedic scriptures, or you can say we're known popularly as the Hare Krishnas, or in Australia we're known as the Haris, but in India we're known as the International Society for Krishna Consciousness and Sadhus, but whatever. You hear about our principles. We do not take intoxication. What to speak of drugs or booze. And that's not to say that we haven't been around the block that we're naive. We have chosen. We just say no. Actually, we have a higher taste. When you get a higher taste, you can give up the lower taste. So we don't take intoxication, and we don't take coffee, tea, or cigarettes. And so people think, how can you live? We don't eat any food that we can't first offer to the Lord, and we try to eat foods which promote a sense of well-being in the body. The body is affected physiologically by what type of petrol you put in it. If you have a big, huge 8-cylinder, Rolls Royce or something, and you put, you know, the lowest grade, fully leaded petrol in it, or I don't know how long it'll last, or how well it will perform. You have to take care of your machine. And the best food is non-violent, and, or you could say, vegetarian food. But we, first of all, offer our food to God. In other words, we're vegetarians. Not necessarily ethical vegetarians or humanitarian vegetarians or whatever. We're not ecological vegetarians. We're not financial vegetarians. And there is a group of people who understand that the meat culture is like a wealthy man's Mercedes or a wealthy man's Rolls, because it is sapping the earth of so many natural resources. The same land could be used to produce food grains to feed 20 times the number of people. But leave that aside. We are Krishnatarians because our focus is on pleasing God, and that is so universal and so all-encompassing that it obviously includes the ecology and ethics and etc. When you have $1,000, all of your $100 problems are solved. Or $1,000, all your 100 bob problems are solved. So that is the reason why we're vegetarians. We also don't engage in illicit sex. We do have red blood, and we do have little children, and they're not dropped by the stork. But some of our members, or most of our members, are married, and they try to live, it's not easy, but they try to live a regulated life. Anything done in excess will cause you problems. Even sex life, it drains the body of nutrients and strength, which can be used for self-realization. Anyway, it's also not the purpose of human life. If you want sex, if you really think that sex makes the world go round, that's the purpose. Purpose of life is ejaculation. Well, you're in the wrong body, because pigeons can have sex 10 times in an hour. So you really ought to be in a pigeon's body. Then you could really go to town. You can go to pigeon bars and pigeon movies and, you know, go out with your pigeon girlfriends and, you know, doesn't matter if they get knocked up because, you know, there's so many pigeons everywhere. But human life is meant for a little equilibrium, right? See that? I don't know what it's about, but this ominous hoarding around town, the movie Equilibrium. I'm sure they're all Krishna conscious, and that's what they're talking about. So when one practices these principles, then he can practice Hatha Yoga. And when one is able to sit nicely, peacefully by practicing certain postures. You also improve the flow of life energy within your body, the prana. You open different channels. You, just like people who have a heart disease, who have heart attacks, generally there's too much cholesterol in their blood veins, so they have to open that channel so the blood can flow. So similarly, on a more subtle level, there are different channels of energy, and this is more subtle, not so well understood. So many things on the gross level that we don't know about the body. We do not know how food is transformed into energy in the body. It's not clearly understood at all. So what to speak of more refined and subtle aspects. So practice of Hatha Yoga is for that purpose, and then the next stage is Pranayama, breathing exercises, which again promote freedom, freeing the prana from its incarceration in the tabernacle, in the body. It's trapped, almost like in a prison cell. Trapped and false, in a false conception. So much for reading this verse, right? Then pranayam, pratyahar, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. The goal of Ashtanga Yoga is not Hatha Yoga. The goal of Ashtanga Yoga is to become free. If you have a problem, you know, you see some of these rugby players or football players. Cricket's not such a rough sport, but still, there are injuries. They get these injuries, and at the time of the match, somebody comes out and sprays a little something on the guy's knee, and he hobbles off, and he tries to come back in because, you know, we don't want to be beaten by Liverpool. You know. But that's not the solution, and after the game, his leg may need further treatment, he may need an operation. That's long-term repair. But we're making a patchwork solution to the problems of life, a bubblegum solution, a Mickey Mouse solution to the problems of life, which are old age, disease, and death, and rebirth. These are the real problems. So the process of yoga and samadhi, to come to samadhi, is to get this power of discrimination, to see the difference between the path of light and the path of darkness, to see the truth, to get oneself on the path, to do something. I'll give you a little instruction on, or a little guidance on love. I'm a love guru. Love is not a noun. Love is a verb. Love means to do something. Love doesn't come from Hollywood. Love means working towards building a relationship. And love means, ultimately, love of God. The highest love is full surrender without expecting anything in return. That's ideal. That is wonderful. Loving the beloved without any motive, and that love is perpetual. It's not interrupted. There may be good times and bad times. We've all had our share. But love is not interrupted. Love is unfettered. It is uninterrupted. Ahoitukiya pratyata. Yayatma supersedati. Atma means the self or the soul. So the soul will be satisfied when he experiences that love, which is uninterrupted, unmotivated, and unfortunately, it cannot and does not exist in this relative world, because we are distracted by lust, covetousness. Lust means to covet. It's the opposite side of love, really. In Sanskrit, the two words are kama and prema. They're just opposite sides of the same coin. But when one thinks that this is mine, I am the enjoyer, I will acquire more and more, and I will enjoy, I am the center of all existence. One is ego-centric in all he does. That is a lusty mentality, whereas love means just giving. My beloved may trample me down with his feet. Doesn't matter. I love him. I've given myself. I'm unconditional love, unconditional surrender. So that is a very wonderful and very rare achievement. And the soul is satisfied because it is constitutional. It's not unnatural for us to love. And I was enjoying the pastimes of one young devotee here, a little girl. And of course, cute, you know. But more than that, she was exhibiting a type of spontaneity that you mostly only see in children. And she has a very natural emotional love for her mother and father. She didn't go to school to take Love 101. She didn't go to, I got a degree from Oxford in love, you know, I know how to love. It's just coming from within. You don't need that. So this kind of love is satisfying to the soul. But it is achieved when one realizes what he is not. In other words, when we talk about spiritual life, and we are talking about spiritual life, yoga means to link with the Supreme Spirit. God is spirit and we are spirit. We are equal to God in quality, not in quantity. But he is spirit. We're a tiny unksa, part of God. He is eternal, we are eternal. He is full of knowledge. As a part, we are potentially also full of knowledge and full of bliss. It is our constitutional nature to be happy. It is our birthright to be happy. We should all be ecstatically happy at every moment, ever increasingly. That's our constitutional position. Not only that we're happy for a moment, but ever increasingly blissful. In an ocean of ecstatic devotion and love. This appears after the cultivation of knowledge. Knowledge is esteemed in the world. Everyone respects a scholar. It's one of the six opulences which make a person attractive. Beauty, strength, wealth, fame, renunciation, knowledge. When someone is very knowledgeable, he's highly respected. Who was it? George Bernard Shaw was so highly respected. When he met Marilyn Monroe, he said, "With my brains and your looks, we could produce a beautiful child. But if there was a change in my looks and your brains, it might not work out." But she was actually very quite intelligent woman, except for her lifestyle. But he's highly respected. There are so many highly respected persons. Stephen Hawking, very highly respected, brilliant person materially, and so many people throughout history. But the Bhagavad Gita, in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says, Bahunam Janmanamante. You can acquire knowledge not only in this lifetime, but for many lifetimes. In other words, when you die, so that's what this verse is about, when you die, you take birth again. And it's not hard to understand, just like evolution theory. Now, Mr. Darwin promised us some missing links, but unfortunately, it's been over 100 years, and, you know, we haven't discovered, he lied to us or something. He assured us that if we just take his theory, we'll see in a very short time. So now we have the neo-Darwinists, and they're also promising, but no missing links. It's still a theory, although we teach it in school, but it's still a theory. And you don't see any example of anyone today who is going through the process of evolution. They have some artifacts from the past, and they hypothecate, they speculate. But we have our theory also, that from boyhood to youth to middle age to old age, the soul is transmigrating. There is evolution, but it's not evolution of the body, it's evolution of the soul. We see it from boyhood to youth to middle age to old age. We all experience this. If you're young today, if you get on a bus sometime, look around you. There are all kinds of people. There are little children on the bus. There's old ladies on the bus. There's, you know, young people, middle-aged people. And you will take every one of those bodies at some stage in your life. You're going to have each and every one of those. But you'll still be the same person. The body's changing, so it's not such a difficult theory to understand. What is so unreasonable? Death is just another change of body. It's going on in this lifetime. You're changing your bodies. So death is just another change of body. So this type of knowledge we need to develop, but after many lifetimes of acquiring knowledge, Bahunam Janmanam Ante, after many, many lives, Bahu means many, Bahunam Janma, Janma means birth, after many, many births of acquiring knowledge, you will realize that there's nothing more than love of God. So the goal is not knowledge. Knowledge is, the culmination of knowledge is love of God. Spiritual life is, again, it's common sense. Common sense. People are suffering, perhaps today more than ever. After the Second World War, we were promised the New Deal, right? There was going to be prosperity for everyone. And capitalism would produce what communism couldn't deliver, and we were all going to have our homes and our cars and our bank accounts, and we were all going to be very happy, and it hasn't delivered. Things seem to be getting worse day by day. The economy's going down. People are suffering in so many ways. I don't know how many wars are going on all over the planet. At one stage I saw there were something like 50 different wars going on. These are not symptoms of a healthy, happy society. there's a pinprick somewhere in the social body. Something is basically wrong. We need some kind of different approach. And I remember years ago, Sir Arnold Toynbee, one of the world's most famous historians, he met with my Guru Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada, my teacher. And he said, according to his study of history, and he was highly respected, he said that civilization had come to the end of a cycle, and we need a totally different approach, much more organic, much a more simple, basic approach with a strong overcoating of spiritual vision. We need to see with eyes that are tinged with the ointment of devotional love. We need to have a vision of a transcendental objective, a transcendental world, a transcendental salvation. Because we all know intuitively, if we can't see it, but we all know at some point, today or tomorrow or in how many years, we're all going to have to vacate. Our lease is up, the apartment is going to be let out to someone. We have to get out. If we don't agree to get out, we'll be kicked out anyway. But people are not seriously making any plans for the next apartment, for their next destination, for their ultimate destination, for any kind of goal, intelligent, rational. You can't go to the airport and say, please give me a ticket to anywhere. I'll think you're off your rocker. Wacko. You can't, give me a ticket to anywhere. You have to have a destination. What is our destination? All right, things are tough, times are tough. I'm just struggling in my life, and I haven't got time for all of this. I just all I can do to go to work, get a little money. I'm tired. I just want to, you know, chill out or relax or watch TV, have a few beers, go to bed, get up in the morning. It's all I can do to keep going. You want me to think of spiritual subject matter? Well, you're going to have to sooner or later anyway. What is the use in going through the same routine over and over again? In India, they have this wonderful, wonderful juice. It's called sugarcane juice. And, where is it from? It's from sugarcane. Brilliant, right? So, but the way they do it is really unique. They have these machines. Now they're mostly motorized, but when I first went there in 72, they had, you know, hand crank, and they had these two wheels that would grind together, and they put the sugar cane, the sticks of sugar cane through, and, you know, ground them up and squeeze the juice out. So I remember the first glass of sugar cane I went for, and there was a man, obviously the owner of the sugar cane juice stand. He had his little son with him. So he put the sugar cane through, and his little son was cranking the machine, and then it went through, and I thought I was going to get my sugar cane juice, but no. He took it and he folded it up again and put it through again. So they squeezed it again, and they did it a third time. The guy broke it over his knees and bent it in half and put it through again, and the son couldn't quite get it over the edge, so his father helped him out, and they pushed it around and they squeezed it through. Practically, by the time I got my juice, the sugar cane was sawdust. Every drop had been squeezed out. And then the guy took the sawdust, or what was left of the sugar cane, and threw it into the street. And then a cow came along and started chewing on it, trying to get a little bit more out of there. It's called chewing the chewed. Punapunas charvita charvananam. That's what we're doing. We're chewing the chewed, the same things over and over and over again. We're not getting satisfaction, but it's all we know. And just like lemmings that run into the ocean, we're following blindly without thinking very much. So human life is meant for people who want to make a solution to the problems: old age, disease, death, birth, death, disease, old age, and new age. These are the problems of life. And we can understand, we can do more than what we are doing. There is a way out. We are not alone in the universe, apart from UFOs. There are people on the planet who also want to make a solution, and by good association we can become inspired. Real knowledge comes from within. It's called realization. It's called vijnana. We talked about jnana yoga. Well, jnana means theoretical knowledge. Jnana spelled J-N-A-N-A. So, jnana. But vijnana means realized knowledge, theoretical and realized. So, realized knowledge, when you know something as a fact, when you feel it very deeply in your psyche, when you have no doubt, asangsayam samagramam yathagyasyasi takshrunu, Krishna says, free from doubt, asangsayam, you can know me as I am, free from doubt. By association of people who are also inspired, and by learning to cut our attachments to deal with the material world. Rather, there are three kinds of people in this world. There are those who watch things happen in their life. They watch their lives go by. They watch things happen. Then there are people who take the bridle by the bit. There are people, they're called proactive, a very trite word, used a lot, but it has meaning. People who get out, they don't react. They get out, and the best way to understand your future is not to necessarily see an astrologer. The best way to understand your future is to get out there and create it. Influence. Do something. Be proactive. Develop transcendental love by learning what to do, how to do, when to do, why to do. By growing intelligently, emotionally, spiritually. So there are those who watch things happen, there are those who make things happen, and then there are those who wonder, what happened? try to be one of the people who makes things happen in a spiritual way. And we don't feel like we have any particular monopoly. We are presenting the oldest theistic tradition in the world, and it is certainly explained in the most voluminous body of scriptures. of any tradition. It's very rational, very philosophical, and yet it culminates in bhakti yoga, or love of God. We're not experts or perfect, but we're trying our best to practice and to teach whatever we know. We are hearing from a very highly realized soul, our founder Acharya. Of course, after him, his disciples are carrying on the tradition, but his influence is just like, you know, Gary Sobers. He didn't create cricket, he didn't define cricket, but was certainly a great player. David Beckham, he didn't create Manchester United, but, or whoever it is, great personalities are there. So Srila Prabhupada is one such great personality in our tradition, in our line, in our sampradaya, and we can see that by his accomplishments. He broke more records than anyone. He established a tiny microcosmic, well, it's actually, well, someday it will be macro, but he transplanted a tiny sample of Vedic India in the Western world. Not easy to do, but he practically transported the culture. When you visit a Hare Krishna temple, you are seeing the closest example of an Indian spiritual community without actually having visited India. I can say that because I've lived in India for some 33 years, and I'm dull, but after 33 years one does learn a few things, and this is quite amazing to find such a temple in the middle of London. It's incredulous. And you're also hearing from the Vedic literatures a very nice description in Sanskrit. Recently, one of the biggest scholars in the Ramanuja Sampradaya, Narayana Acharya, he's a householder. So he's a big scholar. He lives in northern Karnataka. About a year or two ago, he was in Madras and he was speaking to a large gathering of his followers. And at one point, he kind of sat back on his seat and he just began to laugh. And he said, "You people, you don't understand anything." He said, "We are scholars. I am with a group of scholars. We are scholars. We are explaining things that are in a language that none of you, you're sitting here because you're Hindus, but you don't know what we're talking about, really. But, he said, Bhaktivedanta Swami." Then he went on to glorify Prabhupada for no apparent reason. Nobody prompted him. Went on to glorify Prabhupada for about 20 minutes, saying how he had taken the ancient Sanskrit literature. Sanskrit means a language, it can take you 20 years to learn Sanskrit moderately well. Grammar is so exact, and it is such a deep language. One word can have 20 different meanings, 15 different meanings, the same word, used in a different context with different combinations. And the rules of grammar alone can take you 5-10 years just to master. So he has taken this knowledge and he has made it easily available for the common man all over the world in so many different languages. So his accomplishment is very great, and we are here to share with you our lives with him. And I think everyone can benefit, even in their own tradition, if they feel that's important. We are not Hindus, we are not Christians, we are not Muslims, and we are not Jews. We're simply devotees of the Supreme Lord, who is known in Sanskrit as Krishna. So you can benefit. And as I said before, the way to benefit is by association, by coming together whenever you can, whenever you like, whenever you have time, whenever you feel a need. The more you put into something, the more you get out of it, the more quickly you will learn. You can take courses on the internet. You can go to university on the internet and go as quickly or as slowly as you want. Yeah, I've been studying this BA course the last 25 years, and I'm going to get there. Yeah, well, that's nice. And you can come here and digest. And we do want people to understand everything we're doing. You come here, as I said, and you see a simple see. Well, you see some things that you're not going to understand, like devotees bowing down, bowing their heads to the floor. Now, you go a little deeper into that, it's not so difficult to understand. At the time of death, you'll also bow down to the Lord. You'll fall flat. And you'll remain prostrated also. For some men, you remain prostrated continuously. So why not voluntarily learn to be a little humble? Humility never hurt. After all, you might inherit the earth. Who knows? All right, I'm going to stop there. If anybody has any questions, I'll ask him to answer. Anybody have any questions? I challenge you. Yeah.
You say that this Jnana Yoga, this yoga of knowledge, is not so important. So why is it so?
No, I didn't say that. I said it's a stepping stone.
So does this Jnana Yoga include all the knowledge of all the scriptures that we have here?
No, Jnana Yoga is more along the lines of Sankhya, analyzing the material world, and again, as I said, neti-neti, coming to a conclusion about the nature of God by understanding everything that he's not. It's more along the lines of philosophical speculation. And you know, it's very hard to understand God by our limited capacity, to understand the limits of the unlimited is very difficult for those who are limited. The best you can come to following that process is to the level of Brahman realization, or realizing that I am spirit. But that's not complete. I am spirit, no doubt, but now what do I do with that knowledge? Any other questions? Yes?
Is God realization important?
Yes. At nighttime, everything is dark and vague. You cannot see the forms of objects in darkness, especially on a dark moon night. You cannot even see your own body in a pitch black dark room, or on a dark night. It's hard to give yourself, what to speak of the buildings and your surroundings, etc. But as soon as the sun comes up in the morning, the redness is called Aruna, Udila Aruna, Uraba Bhagi. When the rising sun appears in the east, that first light of the sun, you see the sun, and simultaneously as you see the sun, you see yourself. You're able to see yourself. So the best way to understand yourself is to try to understand the Supreme Lord and your relationship with Him. You may be the real you, may be a sports car driver and not a hairdresser, or you know, the real you may be anything you like, but that is superficial, that is external. When you understand that I am a spirit soul, I am eternal, I'm part of God, then whatever you do in this world is simply something that you will do until the end of the body. And of course it's good to be situated in an occupation, in a position where you feel natural and happy. Just like in my youth, the government tried to force everyone to go to war. They had a draft system. Everybody was just picked out randomly. Now, some people were just not suited to war. It wasn't their nature. It was unnatural for them to go to war. They were more inclined to doing business, or more inclined to study, more inclined to labor, whatever. There were some people who were just... My father, he came to Britain to join the RAF. He couldn't wait for North America to get into the war. He wanted to fight. Well, that's not for everybody. So it's obviously it's good to like what you're doing. Happiness is sometimes described as having work that you like to do, rather than work that's just there to earn your bread. That becomes dull and boring and unsatisfying. But having something where, and they in surveys they have concluded in America, because universities have done studies and corporations have paid for studies to be done, what motivates people to work? Because obviously they want their workers to be motivated properly to work for them. So the number one motivation was not salary. The number one motivation was, in most of the surveys, someone feels that they have an environment where they can work and be creative and exercise their natural talents and abilities. They wanted to feel that, you know, being complete in their work. The second one was they wanted to feel like by their work they were making a difference in the world, doing something useful. The third one was salary. So that's important, but it's temporarily important. What's more important is that you have to, not will you, but you have to live eternally. You can't not live eternally. It's not like you chant Hare Krishna and you get saved and you live eternally. You are eternal. But if you remain attached to the physical world, and the temporary material world, you go through constant change, flux, and you can never be satisfied as a spiritual soul. So that's more important. And when you see the Lord, when you understand, when you see by knowing, by serving, you don't see necessarily with the eyes, but you see by hearing. You see by seeing within you. That is real seeing. You see by seeing God in nature. You see by seeing your relationship with God. So when you see God, you will know yourself. That is self-realization. And that is God-realization. One and the same. Not that you are God. That's not the idea. That's not what I was offering from the Bhagavad Gita. You are God, but God as servant. You're not God as master. You are Anu. He is Vibhu. I remember, yeah, I get flashbacks all the time. I remember this little rhyme we had when I went to Sunday school. Little ones to him belong. They are weak, but he is strong. Yes, Jesus loves you. Anyway, I got the point that we're small, we're weak, and he's strong. So that's our situation with God also. Any other questions? Yeah.
On marriage, I think there's a place in the Bhagavad Gita and Srila Prabhupada that we can test to see how we're advancing if we're free from different unwanted things like that. So, I mean, would it be fair to say also that we could test ourselves to see some kind of self-analysis to see how unmotivated or how uninterrupted we are in our devotions?
How uninterrupted? Don't interrupt me. I think once you start the process of thinking about your spiritual life, unless you do something which is very much untoward or something which is inhibiting, you may make mistakes and you may have problems and you may not be perfect in the first week or so, but if you are struggling to know, then your mind will constantly be analyzing yourself. One of my jobs or one of my duties or one of my activities is as a traveling monk, and I meet so many devotees, and a lot of them come to me and they express sometimes some feelings of which might be turned, it's not serious, but sometimes they have a little low self-esteem. Low steam and low self-esteem, both. So, because they're feeling inadequate, that I cannot follow perfectly. And I have no problem in encouraging them that you're doing wonderful, or you're doing wonderfully, because you are attempting something very great, and that in itself is a great achievement, rather than living a life of mediocrity, a life with no inspiration or goal. You're endeavoring for something, and there's no loss or diminution. There's no loss or diminution at all, and you go forward. You only go forward. You may be temporarily stalled, but at a future date you will go forward from that point on. So it's very wonderful. So I just got stalled. What was the question?
About being able to see whether we're motivated, if that can be
we do need to be motivated, and I think one should not analyze. I just spoke to one nice young lady this morning And she was expressing that her feelings of inadequacy or whatever. And I told her that you should not allow anything to dampen your enthusiasm. In other words, the mind is very expert at playing tricks. The material mind can bewilder us. On the one hand, we want to feel humble, and that's good. Pride goeth before a fall. We should recognize that Shabda ke polusham nishu. Krishna says, I am the ability in all men. Whatever ability they have, that is coming from me. There's no need for them to feel separately proud that God is one thing and I am very good for God because I have done this and I am offering it to God and he should damn well be pleased. Punar Mushiko Bhava. In a second you can become a mouse. You know, a little germ can enter your bloodstream and, you know, you're no longer the world's biggest bodybuilder or weightlifter or whatever it is. You're flat on your back. So that kind of pride is chastened by a little humility, recognizing the actual greatness of God. But if your humility comes to the point where you become lethargic and dejected and despondent, then that is maya, that is illusion. Phalena phalakaranam anumiyate. We should judge by the result. Am I becoming enlivened? Am I becoming, is the fog dissipating? Am I seeing things nicely and clearly? Am I feeling satisfaction? Am I actually serving, fulfilling my vows and serving the Lord and serving my spiritual master? Am I undeterred by any kind of obstacle in life? Am I getting stronger? If you're not, then your so-called humility is just a trick, just like, what's his name? I don't remember. Bilbo, or no. Who is that little monster?
Gollum.
Gollum, or somebody or other. Very tricky person. So your mind is just like that. You can never trust your mind really completely fully because he's always thinking, my precious, my precious. My precious sense gratification. So you can never trust your mind. He can be your worst enemy or your best friend. He can lead you to wherever it is they were going to. Or he can lead you somewhere else. So you have to be the judge, finally, but if you balance, spiritual life is like walking a tightrope. It's like shaving with a sharp razor. You have to be careful. See this? I cut myself. Yeah, right there. Ooh, that hurts. I wasn't so careful. I was in a hurry, you know, zip, zip, zip. Blood. It happens in spiritual life. If I'm not careful, I'm sitting here as some kind of an authority, but tomorrow I could fall down off the seat or whatever if I'm not careful. So we all have to be careful, and especially subtly. Yes, it's good to analyze. Yes, it's good to see your progress. Lions, that's what they do. They take 4 or 5 steps forward, then they stop and they look back to see where they've come from. They're the craftiest animals in the jungle. The king of the jungle. But that's what they do. They walk a little forward into the jungle and they turn back. So it's good to analyze what progress you're making, how you're going forward, but don't ever get despondent, because utsah, enthusiasm, is one of the most important elements in Krishna consciousness. Utsah, nischaya, and dhairya. Enthusiasm, determination, and patience. All right, I'm getting the hook from Ilma and her cohorts. All right. Hare Krishna. Thank you.
His Holiness Sri Rama Raj ki
Jai.